For a second, he thought about waiting for another cruiser to show, but the man on the ground had dropped his hands, his head jerking and rolling with each kick, his mouth and jaw flapping open. "Step away, now!" Lester unsnapped his holster, but the Latino didn't even look up, just kept kicking, and Lester repeated his command, this time in Spanish, and now the man stopped. He was breathing hard, and in the light from the pumps, Lester could see the shine of sweat on his cheeks and chin. His shoulders were wide and rounded beneath a black t-shirt, and there was the ornate crawl of prison tattoos on his thick arms. The Latino smiled, kicked the unconscious man once in the head, and Lester drew his pistol, flipped off its safety, but held it at his side and ordered the man in Spanish to lie face down on the ground. But the Latino smiled again, cocking his head back slightly like he was on to Lester's charade, and he began to walk toward him. Lester raised his pistol and aimed it at the man's chest. "Get on your knees, now!" Lester's own knees felt like spun glass, and his voice had a waver in it that he knew was betraying him. The Latino stopped, and Lester felt his finger slide over the sheen of oil on the trigger, his heart pulsing in his nails. The backup car pulled into the lot behind him, its blue flashers spinning across the Latino's face like a strobe. But he didn't look or seem alarmed. He smiled hard at Lester, nodding his head at him and his pointed gun like it was a small problem he would take care of in due time. The officer behind Lester ordered the man down, and Lester jumped, his finger cramping away from the trigger as the big Latino became a shadow sprinting back over his victim and into the darkness around the corner of an auto parts store. Lester gave chase, but the long sidewalk was empty, its street lamps broken except for one 30 yards ahead, casting a dim glow on the concrete beneath it, nothing but blackness on the other side. The quiet street was to his left, closed stores and supply outlets on his right, and he knew the man was probably in one of their doorways. He imagined him crouched down low, ready to pounce. Lester stopped and didn't walk any farther. He glanced once more at the lit section of sidewalk ahead of him, then the darkness beyond, and he backed away and returned to the young Daly City police officer who was calling in an ambulance for the unconscious man. Lester said he'd lost the perp, and the young cop, who was chewing gum, looked at Lester a long moment, then shook his head. Shit. For the rest of his patrol, Lester tried to tell himself he hadn't let a dangerous man go because he was too scared to find him. He tried to take comfort in one of the major directives of the field training manual. Don't get in over your head. Don't be afraid to wait for backup. But the truth was, Lester often felt he was in over his head. That one day, someone would see just how unfit and weak he really was, and then it would be all over. The true Lester would be revealed. And in Daly City, he knew if his backup had responded a half minute later, if that big Latino had kept coming, Lester would have shot him, and probably not in the shoulder or knee either, but where his gun was aimed, at the bully's heart. Because Lester had not only feared the big man with the dark mustache like his own, he had despised him. Despised him because he feared him, and because he was every Chicano Lester ever had to face in Chula Vista, his father gone to Texas, his mother working, his little brother staying inside to take refuge in hours and hours of television. He was Pablo Munoz, Lester's girlfriend's brother, who was over 6 feet and lifted weights and had the flattened nose and cheeks of a Mexican Indian, his eyes dark slits in an almost handsome face pockmarked from acne. He had dropped out of the high school and worked as a forklift operator at the lumberyard across from Lester's house. Lester had first seen Pablo's sister at school in late spring with 4 or 5 Chicanas in hip-hugger jeans and halter tops, their flat brown stomachs exposed. They all smoked cigarettes and chewed gum except for Charita, who was short and lean as a gymnast, her long black hair falling to her waist, where Lester could see 2 small dimples in the brown skin above her buttocks. By the end of the day, he'd introduced himself, and by the weekend had shared 2 tall boy schlitzes with her in the high weeds outside the lumberyard fence, and they had kissed and touched, and she tasted salty and sweet, like a spice he couldn't name. She called him Lester, and one Saturday afternoon she sat on his porch steps with him on Natoma Street, the sun high, all the adobe row houses on both sides almost too bright to look at. She held his hand in her lap, and he could feel the warmth of her skin through the denim. He wanted to take her upstairs to his room, but his mother was home, so it'd have to be the lot next to the lumberyard. The weeds they could lie down in and be seen only by the birds. And he had stood to pull her in that direction when her face changed, her mouth open in a sudden oval, her eyes on something across the street. It was Pablo, dropping down on the other side of the chain-link fence, his forklift's engine running on the other side as he moved swiftly through the litter, snatching off his work gloves, his eyes on Charita as he crossed the street without looking. He wore a faded sleeveless t-shirt, his brown skin sunburned, the muscles of his shoulders rounded and defined. He pushed Lester down with one hand, grabbing Charita's hair with the other, jerking her onto the sidewalk. Charita screamed, her face covered by her hair as she held onto her brother's arm. And Lester jumped back up and didn't remember moving down the steps. He was on the sidewalk, close enough to Pablo to do what he hoped he was going to do, to punch him or grab his arm or kick him in the knees, anything. But Pablo reached over with his muscled arm, put his free hand on Lester's face, and pushed him, Lester backpedaling 8 or 10 feet and falling on his side. Charita wasn't screaming anymore, but crying, saying something to Pablo. Lester stood but could no longer step forward. It was like trying to move quickly through waist-deep water. Pablo Munoz in his thick arms and shoulders, his flat face sweaty and smeared with grime as he held his tiny whimpering sister by the hair and pointed a finger at Les. "I catch her with you again, I will cut your white face off and toast it, gavacho!" He tightened his grip on Charita's hair, and she let out another scream, and Lester's stomach, arms, and legs were a storm of electric nerves. He wanted to run forward, but Pablo's black eyes were on him, so Lester stayed where he was, everything backing up on him, his body suddenly concrete in damp ground. Pablo pulled Charita off the sidewalk. She tripped on the curb, one of her sandals knocking loose, her brother letting go of her hair to grab her arm, and once they were halfway down Natoma, going around the corner for the main entrance to the lumberyard fence, Charita's small dark face looked once back at Lester for a long, hot-faced moment, as if she wasn't quite sure what she'd see there when she looked. Once again, Lester had felt nauseated with shame. He went back inside the house, lay on his bed, and for hours imagined an entirely different scene, him taking Pablo's hand, crushing it in his own, then punching Munoz so hard in the face he'd be unconscious for days and wake up in mortal fear of Lester Burden. Or he imagined himself sidestepping Pablo's arm only to grab it, jerk it behind his back, and break it. And these pictures in his head were not new. He had them for every boy he ever had to fight at Chula Vista High. Maybe because he was tall and quiet and thin, he called more attention to himself than the other Anglos at school. But always it was the same. "Perdón, maricón! Perdón, maricón!" And Lester would try to avoid the fight as long as possible. First, he would deny to himself that that was where this name-calling was really going. He would try to smile off whatever insult was coming his way, and only when he felt the push of hands on his chest would he push back, hoping that would be enough, which it never was. And he would hold up fists he had no faith in, only to be knocked to the ground, where he would stay curled up waiting for a teacher or someone to break it up, or for the bully to lose interest and disappear. But they rarely did. Even when you arrested them, they showed up in your sleep, determined to unmask you and show you to be the coward you really were. Sometimes Lester would wake Carol and tell her his dream, but this was always a mistake, because it just gave her more ammunition in her nearly seasonal attempts to get him to quit the sheriff's department, a job she had never quite accepted or understood him training himself for in the first place. "Not only is it too dangerous," she would tell him, "but my God, you are so above those cowboy simpletons you work for. Any lame brain with a GED can go to the academy and do what you're doing." She'd tell him he wasn't living up to his potential. He should go back to school and get his master's in education, and if there weren't any teaching jobs in California, then she was quite willing to relocate for any job he might get. But Carol was wrong. Lester would sometimes remind her, because he was already a teacher, a field training officer for the San Mateo County Sheriff's Department, one of eight in the entire county, and of those eight, he was the youngest, with only 6.5 years on patrol before they gave him the job. They were all assigned fresh recruits from the academy at Gavilan College, and for 4 weeks at a time, sometimes the 6-to-6 day shift, sometimes the overnight, he'd sit in the passenger side of his patrol car while his young trainee drove, and he would deliberately and methodically begin to unload everything he knew about being a deputy sheriff. And what did he know? He knew if you were taking things personally, you were more dangerous. He knew that he had once put a wife abuser away illegally, and that more and more he found himself coming down harder on some arrestees than others. Not the petty criminals, the car thieves and purse snatchers, shoplifters, or even drunk drivers. It was the bullies, the wife and child beaters, the suspected rapists, anyone who used his weight to crush another. He kept his record clean, but he took pleasure in the arrests, in jerking a wife batterer's arm far up behind his back while he lay face down on the floor or sidewalk. He'd squeeze the cuffs on too tight, then pull him by the wrists to his feet. If he cried out, Lester would lean close to his ear and tell him to shut up. When he put him in the patrol car, he wouldn't bother to guide his head, and he'd let him bump it on the way in. Sometimes they were big men, usually drunk, and Lester would fear them and squeeze the cuffs so tight they cried out. But other times he'd see a wife or child bruised or bleeding, sometimes burned or unconscious, and Lester's stomach would fill with a galvanized, almost nauseating heat, a tremor in his hands and arms as he jerked the man to his feet, sometimes running him face first into a door casing on the way out, sometimes kneeling all his weight on the man's neck as he tightened the cuffs even more. But after these arrests, Lester's rage and adrenaline would fade back, and he'd feel spent and physically weak. Then the remorse would come. Remorse that with each impassioned arrest, he was doing his job less and less justice. And he'd vow not to get sucked in again, to instead perform his duties the way he was trained to. But these vows would fall away like cool ashes the next time he saw the bruised and broken evidence of one more man pushing his poison onto someone smaller and weaker, and Lester's heart would take over again. And then, after the booking, when he was back out on patrol, drinking a soda behind the wheel, trying to fill the desert in his mouth, fear would begin to pool at the base of his stomach like a cold underground spring. Fear that he was beginning to lose control, and it was only a matter of time before one of these perps saw through his uniform and badge and gun, saw that Officer Burden was an imposter, that he was one of those men who has never been in a fight and come out ahead, that all his swagger was really nothing that couldn't be stepped on like a bug. For a few months at a time, Lester was able to control his temper. He'd keep his eyes and ears off the wounded. He'd make the arrest and slip on the cuffs comfortably, escorting the man and sometimes a woman to his patrol car. He'd breathe deeply through his nose, ignore the onlookers, and open the back door. But sometimes the arrestee would struggle a bit getting in, or else yell something to a friend or family member standing nearby, or swear at Lester, and he would slam the door shut, pretending not to notice if his prisoner's shoulder or leg wasn't all the way in the car yet. Again, he was letting his emotion control the situation. Even the Filipino boy out on the coast, he was young and scared, and it would have been impossible for Lester not to feel fatherly toward him and do the right and patient thing. But what if the boy had been a grown man? Would Lester have drawn down on him? Shot him? And at night, lying beside Carol, he'd dream of the parking lot and all of them waiting for him. One night, his own wife and children were out there too, and even figures from his childhood, Pablo Munoz, standing there holding Charita's severed head in his hands like it was something of Lester's he'd left behind. By the third or fourth week of training, Lester would feel he knew the young man behind the wheel fairly well. They'd been spending 9 to 10 hours a day, 5 days a week in a car together. Most of them were gym-hardened and in their early 20s, a slight shaving rash on the throat or upper cheek. And as he and his fully armed student drove through their assigned territory, either the wide green estates of Portola Valley or past the tenements and broken blacktop playgrounds of East Palo Alto, the bodegas, the barrooms with painted-over windows, the boarded-up drugstores, Lester passed on some basic tools and practices of the shift. The proper way to write clear traffic collision and crime reports. What to do when you discover a stolen vehicle. How you go about calling in a vehicle ID over the radio and get access to the computer through the dispatcher. But a deputy's training wasn't all filled with material from the FTO manual. Lester made a point of asking them questions about their home life, their childhood, why they were going into law enforcement in the first place. One boy, his face still full and soft-looking, said he hadn't made it through Marine boot camp in San Diego, so he decided to try this instead. It was rare for Lester to hear such a naked admission from a trainee. Usually, most of them spoke in slogans, the kind of language you see on military recruiting posters on bulletin boards in community colleges. I want to make a difference. I need to make a contribution. I don't know. I feel the need to serve. And that was all fine, but Lester noticed that eventually, as one hour became the next, one day another, spilling into weeks, more than one trainee would begin to open up a bit about his family, the muscles in his face seeming to stiffen as he mentioned his father or mother, the one who was either gone when he was still very young or else stayed around the house much longer than was good for anyone. They spoke in vague terms like this, hunched slightly over the wheel, looking out the windshield into the sunlight at all the civilians in cars or on foot, and once again Lester would see himself, someone who wanted not only to clean up everybody else's act, but to make the world safe again by doing so, to make it right once and for all. Lester went inside the cabin, lit the Coleman gas lantern, then took it out to the clearing and set it on the ground while he gathered an armful of logs for the iron stove. It was too dark now to see the fog in the trees and the clearing anymore, but the air was still heavy with it, and he could smell the ocean, that and the almost earth-yielding scent of split hardwood. It wasn't cool enough to light a fire, really, but he wanted it there anyway. The gas lantern let off a breathing hiss and gave off a white light that gave Lester no comfort at all, and as he carried an armful of wood inside, he felt a well of self-loathing that comfort was what he craved. His young daughter was at home practically holding her breath, and what he really wanted was for Kathy Nicolo to walk into this one-room cabin lit up by the flames from the stove, a sleeping bag laid out on the floor in front of it, for the two of them to undress without a word, to make love without a word, then lie there, their sweat reflecting the firelight, and just feel what they would be now, the two of them. Kathy and Lester. He lit the bald newspaper under the kindling, then got on his hands and knees and blew the flames higher, the newspaper perforated with heat, glowing orange. And he wanted that fireball to be inside him, incinerating those black tentacles. But it wasn't fear, was it? No, it was doubt. Black doubt. And it wasn't comfort he wanted from Kathy, it was reassurance. The silent kind that can show itself in the stillness after lovemaking, the kind that lives beyond speech. He didn't want to hear from Kathy that he was doing the right thing, because honestly, she could never know that. Only he could know that. And he also knew this knowledge would not be complete until he held her again, right now. It was why he didn't drive straight to Alvarez's office, and it was why he didn't take his daughter for a drive or walk and tell her the truth of what was happening. Everything and everyone was stuck in time. It seemed like a month since early this morning when he'd given Kathy a distracted kiss before she backed her car up for him to leave. Where was she? He squatted in front of the stove and laid in two split logs, the ash rising up, some clinging lightly to his forearm. He stepped back and watched the wood begin to burn. The fire seemed to at first diminish, but then grow. Blue and green flames flicking like snake tongues up through gaps between both logs, rising up around the smooth bark, lighting up what it would soon devour. The room felt suddenly too small, and Lester went back outside and stood on the porch, his hands in his back pockets. He thought of Alvarez probably writing up a report on his having disobeyed a direct order. That wasn't good. Men got terminated for that. But they also had sloppy jackets, a code violation here, a write-up there. Despite Lester's excessive arrests, his jacket was clean, not a coffee ring on it. And every time the civil service exam was announced, he'd get a memo from Captain Baldini's office suggesting he'd take it, move to the top 7, then complete the civil service board interview for promotion to sergeant. Career enhancement, the captain called it. But now there was the colonel incident to contend with. Only a couple of hours ago, Lester could have driven into Redwood City and denied it all. His word against some rich Iranian son of a bitch who most likely wasn't even a U.S. citizen. But now, because he hadn't shown up, Lester's integrity and judgment would be called into question, and so too would his innocence. Assuming that's what Alvarez wanted to confront him about in the first place. But Lester felt reasonably certain it could be nothing else. It would have been relatively easy for the colonel to go to Redwood City and file a complaint against the deputy sheriff Gonzalez, only to find out he did not exist. This would have definitely piqued the curiosity of a prick like Alvarez. He'd probably serve the colonel coffee and had him go through the department's photo ID catalog. And Lester thought again how he should have considered all this before he ever put on his uniform and went to Kathy's house, once again his emotion overruling his better judgment. But he didn't want to get caught up in a vortex of should-haves. Regret was fear's big sister, the one he believed should never be let in the door. Lester preferred to watch regret from the safety of an interior window, watch her standing there on the stoop beneath the light waiting patiently, always patiently, to be let in, her long hair prematurely gray, stiff with cold. Sometimes regret would turn to him and smile at him through the window, beckoning him, her teeth straight and clean and transparent as wet ice. For years now she had been standing at Lester's door, waiting. And sometimes she wore a wedding gown, a constant reminder that only 2 or 3 years into his marriage with Carol, he realized it was her conviction he had proposed to, her way of looking at the world with such an angry and compassionate eye. He had assumed, because of her defense of organized religion in their ethics class, that she was some kind of born-again evangelist. But then he'd see her between classes, working a political leaflet table on one of the library patios under the sun. Her blonde hair was long then, and she usually let it hang freely past her shoulders and down her back. She'd wear shorts, and her legs were thick and tanned and muscular. One afternoon, she'd be volunteering at the Palestinians for Self-Rule table. On another day, it would be the South African Alliance to End Apartheid. And on another, the Coalition Against Intervention and Oppression. She was working that one alone, sitting in the shade of a conifer, eating a falafel pita sandwich, when Lester walked over and introduced himself. She nodded and said she recognized him from class, which emboldened him because it was a class of 150 students. He asked her what kind of intervention and oppression her coalition addressed. "Multinational corporate intervention," she said, chewing slowly. "Like what?" She looked him up and down, from his cowboy boots to his black Waylon Jennings Road Tour t-shirt. Then she drank from her bottled mineral water and pushed a pamphlet towards him. He told her he was a sociology major and had too much to read as it was, could she just give him a sentence or two? Months later, she said she was used to getting baited by young Republicans and frat boys who would just end up by cutting her off, calling her anti-American and a slut. But there was something in the way he had asked that made her talk. It was the sincerity in his voice, the lanky, slope-shouldered way he stood in front of her, his deep brown eyes empty of any judgment. And so she began to talk and talk, unloading 3 history courses worth of news. The United States Marines being sent into Nicaragua in the early 30s to kill hungry peasants for United Fruit. The CIA killing the elected leader of Iran in 1953 for oil fields for the Rockefellers. The U.S. government supporting the 14 murderous families who own all the land of El Salvador. She talked and talked, her cheeks flushed red, her voice getting raspy. Lester finally sat on the ground next to the table listening, feeling he was in the presence of someone he hadn't seen in a long, long time. Someone who was as easily outraged by the unfairness of things as he was. The campus street lamps began to come on. She began to run out of gas, and he asked her across town to an outdoor hamburger and beer stand overlooking a pink flamingo miniature golf course. They drank 2.5 pitchers of beer and ate very little, and they talked of their plans after school. She was going to travel to all the battle zones of the world with a camera and notebook and capture the truth of American imperialism. And Lester said he had no idea what he wanted to do, but whatever it was, he wanted it to be good. He wanted to do good. And this seemed to touch something in her. She stopped talking and looked at him, her eyes slightly glazed, her lips parted as if she couldn't quite take in what she had just heard. She looked to him the way he felt, sweetly, almost sadly drunk, and they went back to her dorm room, wedged a chair beneath the knob in case Carol's roommate came home, and made love on the floor with their shirt still on. The following spring, they were married a month before commencement and 3 months before Bethany was born. Lester got a job with a custodial company cleaning restaurants from midnight to dawn, spending the mornings sleeping and the afternoons caring for Bethany, while Carol took a photography course at the community college. Some days he tucked the baby into her carrier and go too, staying in the vocational guidance office to peruse graduate school manuals while Bethany slept or cried, and he'd hold her and walk around the small office humming his daughter a tune, glancing at the announcements and posters on the walls. One afternoon, a new one caught his eye, a huge color photograph of a young cop, barely 30, a handsome Latino, standing between a man and woman, one hand pressed gently against the man's chest, the fingers of the cop's other hand just barely touching the woman's wrist. Her red hair was tousled and her eyes were wet from crying. The man's hands hung at his sides in loose fists, and he was looking down at the ground, listening to or enduring what the cop had to say. Beneath this photo was "World Peace Begins at Home," the phone number of the local police department, and a hotline number for the victims of domestic violence. And there was something about the young cop's face, the strong jut of his jaw, that seemed to keep the man in line that Lester had always seen on other men. And standing there holding his baby daughter to his chest, it felt like the time had come to finally try and take on that look himself. Soon he was at the academy, then out on patrol as a trainee, and when he became a deputy sheriff, they bought the small house in the Eureka Fields complex in Millbrae. Carol got work as a part-time stringer for two local newspapers, and she covered town meetings, dog shows, and land dispute hearings. She was paid $25 a story, and even though they weren't the kind of muckraking exposés she was still interested in, she told Lester she was content to be working at a job that challenged her, yet also gave her the time and flexibility to be a mother and a wife. And there was the trouble. Once the university life was behind them, once Carol's intellectual fires and righteous indignation had died down, Lester began to feel something wasn't quite there between the two of them, something as essential as this, that despite her loving company, her dry wit and erudite conversation, her good south-of-the-border cooking, even the warm timbre of her voice, Lester was no longer drawn to touch her, to hold her, kiss her, taste her, or smell her. And when he did, it never felt quite right. It was as if he was gearing himself up to make love with a close relative, someone from his own family. It saddened and nearly disgusted him that this was all that seemed to separate him from Carol. It made him feel shallow and immature, almost scatological. Over the years, out on the street or on patrol, Lester saw women he could imagine loving, and sometimes he would take their image home with him. The bounce of one's hair, the sway of another's hips beneath her skirt, or the dark eyes of another that held the promise of something more sensual than intellectual. And while his wife and two small children were downstairs or outside, sometimes he'd lock himself in the bathroom, turn on the faucets, and like a teenage boy, masturbate into the sink. And regret grew only more insistent. She didn't just wait on his stoop any longer. She began to wrap her icy knuckles against the door. Lester began to feel as inauthentic a man as was possible, living in a marriage he no longer felt, working as a law enforcer when he'd never been able to face any man down on his own, to serve or protect anyone without the San Mateo County Sheriff's Department behind him. He began to imagine leaving Carol, just packing up and renting an apartment on the other side of town. But then he would think immediately of Bethany and Nate, their small round faces looking up at him in mute disbelief just before they cried and cried. Also, he would be responsible for supporting two households. There would be child support, maybe even alimony, and the mortgage payments too, none of which combined he would ever be able to handle with his salary. But this was not the whole story of why he stayed, and he knew it. Sometimes, while out on overnight patrol, driving down the dark, empty streets or back roads at 3 or 4 in the morning, his dispatch radio turned low, sipping a cool coffee, he knew what it was, and he would allow himself to acknowledge that bright Saturday morning in his boyhood in June, the used white station wagon their father had bought for his move to Brownsville, Texas, parked in front of their house on Natoma Street. It was the trunk and two suitcases on top. It was the way the late morning sun made everything almost too bright to look at, the white wagon and its white wall tires, his father's white button-down shirt, the way his gut always pushed his belt buckle out, which was too bright too. It was Lester's 12-year-old brother's t-shirt as he helped their father tie the canvas to the shining chrome rack. It was the smell of coffee and biscuits coming from the house, the way his mother had made everyone breakfast as though this was a normal Saturday morning. It was the way she'd serve them plates of eggs, pouring the boys juice and milk, their father coffee, all the while asking her husband sincere-sounding questions about his new job with the Border Patrol in Brownsville, as if he didn't already have a job in Chula Vista, as if he was moving to Texas for them. But mostly, it was the way she stayed in the house when it was time for their father to leave, the way he patted her shoulder once on his way out the door, like she'd just gotten some bad news he had nothing to do with. Lester sat on the porch steps and he could feel the whole quiet house at his back. And his father just stood there on the bright sidewalk, his hands on his hips, a package of Terryton straining against his heart pocket, and he looked at 16-year-old Lester sitting on the steps like he was waiting for his firstborn son to do the polite thing and stand and see him off. His father glanced at the house behind Lester, then looked at him again, nodding once, as if to say, "Okay, if that's the way you want to play it." Then he shook his youngest son's hand. Lester's brother began to cry, and their father turned as quickly away as if it was something private he wasn't supposed to see. He was hearing the wagon's engine start up, watching the car pull away from the curb and move past the adobe row houses in the open sunlight for the stop sign at the corner of Las Lomas. It was seeing just the side of his crying brother's face as he watched the car grow smaller, his thin shoulders jerking up and down, his hands hanging loose at his sides. It was looking back at the corner and seeing no car at all. It was how hot it got that day. The way you could smell the old paint in the trim boards, the dog shit in the adjoining yard, the dry concrete of the sidewalk, the lumber from the building supply warehouse across the street. For almost a decade with Carol, all the heat and light of that one day was enough to keep the cool regret of his own marital decision at bay. But everything changed when he walked into that little house on the hill in Corona with a suit from the Civil Division. Kathy Niccolo Lazzaro appearing in her terry cloth bathrobe, her toenails painted pink, her hair wild, her small dark face all incredulous but brave about the news they delivered. Lester had felt a wanting rise in him so deep and immediate his throat flushed, but still he couldn't look away from this Mrs. Lazzaro as he watched her take in the bad news about her house. As he stood there in his uniform and gun belt, his desire so fierce it could almost be a noise in the room. And that changed too, his feeling there was no room to move. With his hunger for Kathy came the new belief that maybe it wasn't too late. And this feeling only grew when on a hard, wide bed at the Eureka Motor Lodge, she actually took him inside her, took in his hunger with a hunger of her own that was dark and slick and more heated than any day in Chula Vista. Regret seemed to slide away from his stoop, and with her absence came a picture in his head of having a place of his own, a house where his children would have their own rooms, maybe a house on a hill in Corona. Kathy had hinted at this scenario, the fact her house had 3 bedrooms. Then Lester would only have to deal with child support payments and maybe half the mortgage on the house in Millbrae that wouldn't be his anymore. He could manage that. Maybe it was time he did take Captain Baldini up on one of his memos and go for his sergeant stripes and the raise in salary that went with it. And with a sudden heat in his face, Lester thought again of shirking off Alvarez. That wasn't smart. Maybe he should drive down there now and slip a note under Alvarez's door, offer his apologies, and explain that circumstances beyond his control had kept him from reporting in. And that would be accurate, wouldn't it? But that would take too long, and Kathy might show up while he was gone. Lester went back inside the cabin, and in the light from the fire in the stove, he wrote her a note on the back of a grocery bag. "It's almost 8. Don't go anywhere, Kathy Nicolo. I'm off to make a call to work. I love you. Les." He put the bag on the table. Then, to draw her attention to it, he placed the empty wine bottle on top. He swung the fire door shut on the stove, then went out to the clearing lit by the stark light of the hissing Coleman lantern, picked it up, and walked back up the trail to his car. He hoped Kathy's Bonneville would pull into the turnoff road right then, but the road was dark and quiet, the cracked asphalt covered by a fog bed that, when he drove through it, rose swirling over his hood and windshield like spirits. He felt momentarily that he was somewhere exotic and dangerous, and he thought of the Iranian colonel, the photograph of him at a party with one of the richest sons of bitches in the world, a man with his own secret police force. The night Lester paid him a visit, the colonel had seemed to be in his walking around clothes, but Lester had noticed how finely tailored the pants had been, the shirt, too. And when Behrani spoke, his words were clear and unhurried, like a man used to being listened to. It would be hard for Alvarez to resist a slick bastard like that, Les thought. And as he drove through the fog up the coast highway, keeping his eye out for Kathy's Bonneville in the opposite lane, he wondered just how far this thing could go. Would he be charged simply with conduct unbecoming an officer? Maybe receive a letter of reprimand? Or a day's suspension without pay? Or could it get hotter than that? Would his threat to Behrani be interpreted as the extortion it was? Leave this property or else? But you needed evidence or corroborating witnesses for that kind of charge, so he was probably in the clear on that count. Still, there would be the dark spot in his file, which might very well hurt his chances with the Civil Service Board. On the coast road in Montara, Les pulled the car into the lot of a gas station convenience store and used an outside phone to call the department in Redwood City. He left a message on Alvarez's voicemail, apologizing for missing him and saying he would be in the lieutenant's office first thing tomorrow morning. He hung up, then called the number that until this moment he had associated with home. He wanted to talk to both his children, even if it meant waking them up. Nothing too lengthy or serious. Just tell him he was working and that he loved them and would see them tomorrow sometime. But on the 4th ring, the machine picked it up. He hadn't expected that. He pictured Carol probably reading a story to one or both of them, and he felt wounded at this image of her, holding herself up for the children. Then he heard her cheerful voice tell him the Burden family couldn't come to the phone right now. Please leave your name and number or call us back. Les waited for the beep, but the silence that followed felt like a black emptiness he could not imagine speaking through to his son and daughter. He hung up, then felt like a fool because Carol would surely know it was him. A car passed on the beach road behind him, and he turned quickly to its sound, but it was a black El Camino with mud-splattered wheel wells, and he stood there and watched its tailgates get engulfed into the fog. He could hear the surf out on the beach. He looked up the highway, but saw no more headlights piercing the mist. Something was wrong. But then everything was wrong. He shouldn't be standing at some outdoor payphone hoping for Kathy to drive by. And they shouldn't have to rendezvous at a place like Doug's Fish Camp, either. Not tonight, squatting in some poker shack as if they were both on the run. Lester stood in the electric light at the payphone and watched the fog move along the sandy surface of the parking lot. His hunger had vanished, but now he felt scattered and shaky, not quite rooted in his own feet. Nothing was rooted. Everything was suspended in midair until Kathy's presence, and then what they would do next, made it all move again. He could go inside the store for a chili dog or a cup of coffee, but he knew the owner from night patrols, a big gray-bearded man who liked to talk and would never take Lester's money but seemed instead to expect conversation as payment. And usually Lester didn't mind this. The man was intelligent and genuinely warm, and speaking with him felt rarely like a waste of time. But Lester didn't want to talk. You had to look into a person's face then, let him look back into yours, and he didn't feel capable of either. He was beginning to feel something was truly wrong. No longer demons of the Horror 24, and no longer simply the image of his daughter's face peering up at him so still from her bed. The stillness he felt was the kind a deer goes into right after the hunter's boot breaks a fallen twig. It raises its head and sniffs the air, the unlucky ones taking the moment to turn their glistening dark eyes to the trouble they smell, to the bright orange vest, the oiled bore of a large caliber exit out of this life. Lester got into his Toyota and pulled into the fog of the coast highway, heading north for Point San Pedro and Corona. The fog was so thick his headlights were reflected off it, and he had to drive slow and careful.
I'm naked, and my breasts are flattened against a bed of smooth, black stones in shallow water on the beach. It's low tide, and the small waves push me forward when they break, then pull me back, and I can feel the stones under me, but instead of being cool and wet now, they're hot and dry, and I want to stand and leave, but my body is too heavy, and the beach in front of me is as gray as ash, and sticking out of it, in dozens of places, is Lester's black gun, the handle, grip, or barrel. Hundreds of them. And toys, too. Half buried in gray sand, old frisbees, plastic bats and rubber balls, and a red tricycle, its wheels mostly covered. My throat is a scorched pipe to my stomach. The waves roll me, and now they're hot too. And I begin to cry, and the water pulls back, dumping me into the gray sand full of guns and toys. And the waves are taking so long to come back, I think they must be pulling up into one huge wall of water. I can feel the still air at my back, and I dig my hands into the sand and drop my face to it and wait for the final crush of water, my whole body stiff, but nothing comes. Nothing happens. I hear birds. Seagulls. I raise my head and see my husband and Lester walking together on the gray sand. Their shirts are unbuttoned, both of them tanned, even Nick, who has lost some weight. I call his name, but my throat is so dry, no sound comes. Then they see me and they both start fucking me, taking turns. Then Lester pulls out and comes onto my hip and side. And he keeps coming, and it starts to cover me, weighing me down, and doesn't stop. And now it all begins to harden, and I've become a stone, a smooth white stone among all the black stones. And the air smells like spiced tea. Someone touched my wrist, and I saw the colonel's wife bending close, looking at me. Her brown eyes were a little bloodshot, and she looked at my upper arms and touched the bruise. She shook her head and said something softly to herself in her language. Then she pushed my hair back out of my face and smiled. "Please, you must fordrink this." There was a tray on the chair by the bed, a clear glass of hot tea, a saucer full of sugar cubes, and a plate of sliced kiwi fruit, green with tiny black seeds in it. She sat on the side of the mattress and reached for the tea, but my stomach curled in on itself and my mouth filled with spit, and I had to scoot past her to the foot of the bed, and in the bathroom I threw up. Nothing but liquid. Then I heaved air twice, my ribs and throat hurting, and I rested my forehead on my arms. I still felt a little drunk. I closed my eyes, but there was tilting dark. I opened them, remembered talking to Frankie, getting nothing from him, and I was at the mall drinking there, and there was a woman crying in front of me, a cash register, a boy with a skinny neck. I wiped my mouth with toilet paper, then used it to clean the splatter on the rim. I sat on the lid, which was covered in thick lamb's wool, the kind rich people put on the front seat of their cars, and I wanted to press the flush handle down, but I felt too weak right then to turn around and do it. The sink and mirror in front of me were so clean they were almost too bright to look at. I lowered my head and looked at the thick gray carpet on the floor. I tried to remember what this floor looked like when it used to be mine. My throat was dry as sand, but I felt too shaky to drink. I remember driving up the hill, seeing the house, everything a white swirl. The colonel's wife knocked softly on the door, and I must have answered because she walked in, carrying a fresh towel and a rose-colored bathrobe. She rested them on the sink, pulled the shower curtain aside, and started the bath water running. She turned and looked down at me, the way mothers do with young kids who are sick, and she smoothed my hair away from my face. It felt so good and bad that my eyes filled up and I had to look down. "Please have bath for to relax. I'm for us cooking. Perhaps you will wish to eat." She closed the door behind her. I stood to lock it, but I stood too quickly and the room seemed to pull me down and back. Through the door I could hear water running in the kitchen sink, the colonel's wife speaking over it in their language. Then I heard the lower voice of the colonel, and I remembered him as a blur against the gray light, unloading Lester's gun, putting it in his pants. Did I dream that? I didn't know. A black sky opened up inside me. I felt so suddenly afraid, so far away from the solid feel of a real moment in my old life that I couldn't move. I had a feeling about my chest, and I touched my fingers to my sternum. I could feel a tenderness. The barrel of Lester's gun. And I started to cry, and I remembered the fat woman crying, me pointing the gun at her through the glass. And through the bathroom door I could hear silverware being pulled from a drawer. I could smell cooking meat, tomatoes and onions. And I thought I might throw up again, but I was too weak to get on my knees, so I leaned my hands on the sink, but nothing came. I looked into my reflection, saw the tear trails over the accountant's daughter's blush still smeared so pink into my cheeks, my eyes flecked with red veins swollen underneath, my hair sticking out. I was so dirty, so deserving of everything bad that had ever come my way or ever would again. I jerked open the mirrored cabinet door. On the clean glass shelves were white boxes of Band-Aids and cold cream, tubes of antibiotic lotion, a jar of French aspirin, two small maroon boxes with Arabic or Persian writing on it, an alphabet of snakes, and on the lowest shelf, a brown plastic prescription bottle to Mrs. N. Barani, Halcyon. It was 3/4 full and my heart was beating in my fingertips, in the palm of my hands, my bowels loosening. I pressed down on the cap, turned, and pulled it off, my hands trembling. A chill up my arms and back, my nipples erect against a shirt I'd stolen from a girl, somebody's daughter, one I would never have, a son either. Family waste. My road was a circle of shit, rising up to the west only to fall back to the east, to this, to taking off all my clothes in a stranger's house, in the house of my father, who was always a stranger to me, stepping naked over the carpet, running water in the sink. No more running, the tablets going down my throat like little embryos of solution. No enemy voices in my head, just a surrender to my cupped hands under the sink faucet as I drank and swallowed, seeing the cleaning calluses on my palms and wondering who will take over my client's cleaning. This is what I thought of as I stepped into the water that was so hot goose pimples came out on my skin. I was thinking, who will keep the houses and offices clean of filth? Who will be there to take on everyone else's grit and dust and bad news? I lowered myself slowly in, my spine softening in the heat, my hands clammy on the porcelain bath. With my bare foot, I pushed the faucet knob in and shut off the water. Through the bathroom door, I could hear Mr. and Mrs. Barani speaking in that tongue that sounded older than the earth. No longer malicious voices to me. No great malice to accuse anyone of. Water dripped from the faucet into the bath, and for a while I listened to each individual drop as it hit. The plimp of them. Their plimp, plimp, plimp. I began to count them. When I reached 36, I started over, each drop a year getting sucked by gravity into everyone else's years, and 36 may as well be 100. I closed my eyes to a darkness that no longer moved, and I kept counting, but did it from 1957 this time. 58, 59, and I hoped the colonel's wife wouldn't blame herself too badly. I hoped she'd lay me down on her brass bed in my and Nick's old room on those nice carpets. 70, 71. She'd wrap me in lamb's wool and try to make me up as beautiful as her daughter. And they'd stand around me in the candlelight and speak in their old tongues, mothers and daughters, blood and breasts. 90, 91, 92. And the milk is for everyone. Please drink. Please. Please.
It is clear to me once again that my nadire is most happy when called upon to serve and nurse the weak. While this Kathy Nicolo bathes herself in the washroom, I sit on a stool at the counter and watch my wife carry the steaming dishes of rice and augouste to the soufre laid out upon the carpet in the living room area. She has surrounded it with our fattest pillows from Tabriz, and she scolds me in Farsi to please remove the newspapers, glue, and mending table from the area, her voice still charged with the sense of purpose that lifted her from the darkness of her bedroom when I told her of the desperate girl under our roof. When I revealed the pistol, she slapped me hard upon the shoulder and rushed to put on her robe, telling me in Farsi, "This is your fault, Behrani. You have done this." But since that moment, she has spooned no more blame onto my plate. She is deeply occupied in her tasks, setting the masvachiar and bread upon the soufre, placing a damp towel over the rice pot to keep the steam imprisoned there, and she hums a love song by Gougouche, as if there were not a pistol and fully loaded magazine upon the countertop, as if the woman inside our washroom had not actually attempted to turn it on herself in our drive earlier today. Nonetheless, Nadi's elevated mood helps my own, for she becomes quite beautiful when she is filled with the feeling she is needed, and I am of course hoping her beauty will further soften this Kathy Nicolo, that, and a traditional Persian meal, and our forgiveness of what she had come here to do. Well then, perhaps, after all this, she and our friend Lester V. Burden may be more willing to leave us alone, to aim their anger instead at the county taxman who took from her this home. In my office, I carefully laid Nadi's mother's table on its face upon the floor. Kathy Nicolo is silent within the bathroom, and I feel indecent to have taken note of this. I return to the kitchen and living room area and sit at the counter. Between the steaming dishes upon the floor, Nadi has placed 3 lighted candles in a small candelabra upon the soufre, and she has extinguished the lamp near the sofa, and the bungalow smells wonderfully of meat and saffron rice and cooked tomatoes. I have a large hunger and hope Kathy Nicolo presents herself very soon. I pick up the weapon once again. It is well maintained and smells strongly of gun oil. I pull backwards on its ejection mechanism and allow it to slide back into position, and the sound it makes startles Nadi, and she nearly drops the warm plates in her hands. "Nakon, Masur," she tells to me to put the weapon out of sight of the poor girl, and I apologize to my wife for frightening her. But I do not yet put away the pistol, for I am thinking of my Friday afternoons during the months before Ramadan, when Purat and I would use the firing range built by the Americans at Mehrabad. We would wear headphones and smoke French cigarettes, and we would fire with one hand or two, attempting to shoot holes into the black silhouettes of paper men at the far end of the gallery. Pourrat was not comfortable with his weapon, a 9mm pistol such as Kathy Nicolo's, and he would jerk the trigger and miss the entire target, and his bullet would disappear into the sandbags against the concrete wall. But General Pourrat did not care. He laughed at himself, even in the presence of the soldiers posted at the door, and he would give to me the weapon, and I would allow him the use of my .45 caliber with the cowboy and rearing horse in its grip, and Pourrat would shoot even less accurately with that. But I was younger, my eyes clear, and many times I held my breath and squeezed the trigger and made a substantial number of holes in the chests and stomachs of the paper men. Later, Pourrat would boast of my shooting to other officers. One year, all the spring season, he called me Duke Berani, after the American actor John Wayne. But of course, Pourrat's laugh was always last, for in Farsi, Duch sounds very much like our word for liar. I laid the weapon and its loaded magazine on a folded paper towel and set it against the flower pots upon the counter. Outdoors, in the twilight fog, comes the familiar metallic rolling sound of my son's skateboard wheels upon the concrete sidewalk. I begin to prepare myself for speaking with him, and when he enters the home wearing only shorts and basketball shoes and a loose black t-shirt, I scold him for both underdressing and for dressing too darkly as well. In the doorway he stands as tall as a man. His black hair is matted wet upon his forehead from the fog and his own sweat, and his eyes survey the soffre, the four plates there, instead of three. Nadi is near to the sink preparing the samovar for later, and she calls out in Farsi for a smile to take off his shoes and then come into the kitchen for washing. She regards me, her hands upon the samovar lid, and she motions with her head for me to commence explaining. A smile removes his shoes, asks me if the automobile in the driveway does not belong to that woman, Baba John. Again, I am faced with the moment of not knowing how much of our situation to share with my son. But then I tell to myself it is his situation as well. The woman Kathy Nicolo has slept in his bed. I ask my tall, handsome son of 14 years to the counter, where I show him the unloaded weapon and tell him everything. Esmail's face looks as it did when he was a small boy, before he had his own television, computer, and video games, when he was still interested in stories of people, of hearing me talk of soldiers and their triumphs or failures, hearing his mother or older sister speak with pity of crippled beggars in the marketplace. His eyes would grow larger, more round, and a bit moist with a curiosity so sharp it became nearly fear as well. He appears this way now, and his eyes linger on the weapon as I speak. Twice he turns and looks down the corridor to the closed bathroom door. Nadire approaches him, wiping the samovar lid with a dry cloth. In Farsi, she says that the woman is not well. "You must be a gentleman, Junam, very kind, very polite, very quiet." She asks him to quickly retrieve long pants, a shirt, and socks from his room, and he may dress in her bedroom and wash at the kitchen sink. Our son's eyes have changed now. They shine with the joy of adventure, and soon he is dressed and clean and sitting upon the floor at the sofre, the light from the candles in his eyes. I sit there as well, giving to him permission to eat bread, perhaps a torupche, a radish. The covered dishes are cooling, the candlesticks burning shorter, and soon the scent of the samovar's tea will fill the room. So I tell to my wife to please inform Kathy Nicolo of her waiting meal. Nadi disappears into the hallway, knocks upon the bathroom door. "Please, hello, your food is to be eating soon. Hello?" My son and I smile at one another over Nadi's English. We eat bread and listen to her knock again. But there is only silence. Too much silence. And it is in this silence my heart quickens and I stand. I hear Nadi turn the knob and open the door, and I am moving down the darkened corridor in my socks, a prowler against my own knowledge of what is to come. I should have taken more precautions with this woman. I curse myself, and I am not surprised when my wife screams, and I enter the bathroom and see in the sink the empty pharmaceutical bottle. Cathy Nicolo lying nude in the clear water, her face as white and still as if she were in the deepest of sleeps. Nadi cries out in Farsi that we must hurry, we must make her lose her stomach. I avert my eyes from the woman's breasts only to see the darkness between her legs. My face becomes very warm, my limbs clumsy. Nadi pulls on her wet arms, and Cathy Nicolo opens her eyes, but they are narrow and quite dark, as if she were blind or seeing us only in a dream. Nadire appears startled, but she regains herself and without turning around orders me in Farsi to leave the room immediately. I obey. A smile is standing there as well, and I know he has seen the naked woman, but I say nothing of this.
What happened, Baba?
I tell to him to return to the Sofre and eat his dinner. My son opens his mouth to speak once more, but I shake my head and point my arm to the living room area. He does nearly as I instruct, except he does not eat at the Sofre. He fills his bowl with rice and abgusht and sits at the counter bar, where he has a view of the corridor and me and the bathroom's closed door. I stand there listening, but the sound of my own heart fills my ears. I turn the knob and open the door a fraction. My wife speaks softly, half in English, half in Farsi, and the woman Cathy Nicolo speaks as well, but I cannot understand her words, for they are in the high, bewildered tone of a child. Yes, good, Nadi says.
Imboshe, bio, very good.
There is the sloshing of water, the rustle of a towel, and Cathy Nicolo's voice telling to my wife she is very beautiful. But the words are thick, and her statement sounds more to me as a question would. Nadire thanks her and tells to Cathy Nicolo that she too is beautiful.
Cheli ziba,
then Nadi says, Bioinja, come to here, please. And I hear only silence. Then Nadire speaks again.
Yes, your mouth to open.
Cheliho, very good. Her voice is near the door, and I am certain the two women are upon their knees at the toilet. Cathy Nicolo asks a question, but once again I cannot understand the words. They are merged one over the other. She begins to cough and retch, and there is silence, then her vomit hitting the toilet water. I return to the living room area, but the smells of abgusht and saffron rice no longer attract me. I sit beside my son at the counter, my heart a presence in my hands, and I tell to him to finish eating. He fills his spoon with rice.
Baba John?
Yes. She took Mammon's pills, huh? Yes. A smile eats his rice and drinks from his glass of cola. He is excited by all this, and I can see he is attempting not to allow this to show upon his face. Perhaps I should telephone an ambulance. But what can they do my Nadi is not already doing?
And with them may come policemen as well. More trouble, though we have done nothing wrong.
I pull the weapon to me once more, rub my fingers across its black plastic grip.
Because of health?
Chew your food before you speak, son. I did not understand. A smile swallows, wiping his face with a napkin. I said, is it because of the house, Baba? Is that why she keeps trying to kill herself? There is a grain of rice on my son's chin. His eyes look directly into my own. I brush the rice from his face and tell to him the truth.
My name is Dunam.
I do not know. A smile looks down the corridor to the closed washroom door. Then he regards the food upon his plate, the stewed tomatoes and meat, their juices soiling the white rice. I feel sorry for her. We should have moved, Baba John. I take a deep breath, but my patience is not tested. I am simply very tired, tired of all this turbulence in our life. I want peace. I want peace and silence and no more loud emotion.
A smile does not eat. It is as if he is waiting for my response. Bichor, I tell to him, eat. And I leave the counter bar and return to the washroom door to see if Nadi has finished saving this young woman's life, has perhaps even caught it in her own two hands. In Corona, the fog was so thick the street lamps above the sidewalk appeared only as dim approximations of light, and as Lester drove slowly by the beach shops and boutiques on both sides of him, he could only just begin to make out the square glow of their windows. In the 10 blanketed miles from Montara, only 2 cars had passed him going in the opposite direction, and one had the heavy axle rumble of a half-ton truck, the other the high RPM whine of a small foreign car. But no Bonneville. He kept picturing Kathy at the storage shed in San Bruno, all of her possessions there. Maybe she'd loaded more things into her car and then was too spooked by the fog to drive. There was no phone at the camp for her to call. She might be at Carl's Jr. a mile down the road, waiting for the air to clear. Or she might have gone inside the truck stop bar. Lester's stomach grew hot at this image of Kathy, sitting alone in that dark place full of independent truckers coming off days on the road alone, men who wore their loneliness on their shirt sleeves like a badge in need of a polish. And despite himself, Lester began to imagine one of the younger ones, maybe a lanky kid from San Diego or Phoenix, buying her a drink, or more, asking her for a dance. And he felt almost queasy at this, like a high school kid desperate over his first crush. He was ashamed of feeling this way, and he knew then he wasn't completely sure he trusted Kathy, did he? Under the right circumstances, would she give herself to someone else as completely and quickly as she had to him? But again, he felt ashamed of himself. Right now, everything was floating completely out of proportion. Nothing felt grounded or real. There was no proportion at all. He would drive to San Bruno and look for Kathy there. It was practically their entire geographical frame of reference. If she wasn't at the storage shed, or the truck stop bar, or the El Rancho Motel, then he would try Carl's Jr. on the other side of the freeway. And if that didn't pan out, he'd drive south to Millbrae, to the Cineplex, where she could possibly be at the movies. Ahead of him in the fog, Corona's main street ended at the base of the hills and the intersection for the turn to Hillside Boulevard in San Bruno. The blinking yellow traffic light above was so obscured it looked to Lester more like a silent pulse. Kathy would not be at her stolen house up in the hills, but the colonel would, and there was no crime in cruising slowly by. He was off duty and out of uniform. Lester downshifted and drove straight through the intersection to Bisgrove Street. The fog thinned slightly as he accelerated up the hill past the partially lighted shapes of houses on his left, the dark woods on his right. His blood seemed to be moving faster, his senses heightened. He rolled his window down and could smell the ocean, the faint scent of something else in the salt water, his fingers after being with Charita, both of them 14 against the sun-dry fence behind the lumberyard, the way she let him put his hand down her jeans into her underpants. And Lester had only heard of the hole there, never even seen a picture, and he kept rubbing the coarse hair over her pubic bone, waiting for it to open up into what was supposed to be there. They were kissing, and his erection was bent inside his pants, and she kept arching her back till finally his fingers slipped lower and inside the warm, wet answer to his own question. And there, near the top of the hill, in the light from the flood lamp over the front door, was Kathy's red Bonneville, parked behind the colonel's white Buick Regal, as if it had always been there. The colonel's light cast out over the small yard and made the low mist covering the ground appear almost like snow. Lester pulled the car over onto the soft shoulder against the trees. For a moment he didn't move, just sat there and looked at the house, his confusion so stark he didn't feel relieved so much as he did hurt that Kathy had left him out of this, whatever this was, as if it were a party of close friends to which he hadn't been invited. Through the front window came the light from the kitchen, and Lester saw what looked like a teenage boy sitting at the counter eating. Low on the floor in the front